Across Eye in the World, I'm John Batchelor. The Decisive Decade, the new book from Jonathan D.T. Ward, American Grand Strategy for Triumph Over China. Jonathan, I tell the story of three members of the cabinet, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of Commerce. Beijing does not want the Secretary of State to visit, I'm told. Beijing wants the Secretary of the Treasury to visit, I'm told. Beijing is unclear whether it wants the Secretary of Commerce to visit. However, it might. Why? Two poles. Engagement, that would be Treasury, and maybe Commerce. Or competition, that would be State. This is diplomacy, practiced now at the global level. China has an advantage in that it veers between wolf warrior and the charm offensive. Does it want to engage the United States and our secretaries, or does it want to defeat them, compete with them? What is Beijing's point of view? Why is it hesitant about State?
Well, John, Beijing understands that the U.S.-China economic relationship works overwhelmingly to their advantage and overwhelmingly to our disadvantage. They've been able to rise from an agrarian state in the 1980s to a industrial and technological superpower today. And that has basically been built through engagement with the United States, through access to U.S. and world markets, to access to our capital and our technology. So they would like that to go on for as long as possible. And at the same time, they would like to ensure that we fail to win this longer contest that they have frankly brought to us. So, you know, as State catches on and as State, I think, gives voice to the security challenges, and as Treasury certainly makes many of the opposite noises. I mean, we saw recently in a speech from the Secretary of the Treasury that apparently we are not trying to create an economic advantage over China. I mean, that was the declaration of a total absence of a U.S. grand strategy, or at least such deep contradictions that there, you know, will be no real effect in winning this game. So I think Beijing knows how to play us. I mean, they like to have our business leaders go over there and come back to Washington. They know that economic engagement works for them and is ultimately going to lead us to, a sort of a geopolitical grave. So, that's how they want to play this game. And in the meantime, the fact that they won't receive the Secretary of the State, and as we, apparently is the situation, is that they don't like what we've said about their balloon, their spy balloon traversing the United States.
Yes,
we can see that this is
balloon,
a totally hostile state.
That balloon,
so,
John, if that balloon hadn't existed, we would have had to make it up. It's almost an operatic, the way the balloon floated in the first act, and we've been talking about it ever since. And I agree with you, the balloon has upset them in some fashion that I hadn't anticipated.
Well, they'd like to get away with everything they're doing, and they like when we let them do that. So that's the big question for America is, are we going to keep playing this game that digs our geopolitical grave or not? And that's why I think for diplomacy and in the diplomacy arena, I mean, the diplomacy that matters to the U.S.-China contest is the diplomacy with everyone but China. This is no longer, in my view, about engaging Beijing. And yes, it would be nice to have guardrails, but if they won't pick up the phone, what can you do? What really matters is our consolidation of our own alliance system, and then the possibility of pushing China back across the emerging world, breaking the Belt and Road.
Explain that, Jonathan. You went too fast. Pick up the phone. What is that about?
Well, I mean, we're hearing that China won't take our call right now when it comes to guardrails.
So you've heard the same thing. When the President of the United States calls the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping is not available. Is that what you've heard?
I think this is more on the diplomatic and military side that we're not getting the warm welcome.
That's a difficult thing to say. It's an engagement. But I want to move to not the battlefield, the chessboard. The chessboard you call the emerging world in your book. And I agree with you. It's the Indo-Pacific, especially the island chain. It's Africa, especially the resource-rich parts of Africa, sub-Sahara Africa. And it's the Americas. Let's begin with the Indo-Pacific, the first island chain. You mentioned Wang Yi, the very sophisticated diplomatic, chief diplomat of China, who lectured, I believe, our Secretary of State and our National Security Advisor as an opening round in 21 of the way China was going to approach the U.S. under Mr. Biden. He has recently made it clear that Kiribati, Samoa, Fiji, and Vanuatu are of great concern. This is Belt and Road talk. Why, Jonathan? What do they represent?
Well, look, China's Belt and Road strategy is both an economic and a military strategy. So they envision multiple what they call maritime economic corridors. One goes through the Indian Ocean, another goes through the Arctic sea route. And by the way, they now have Arctic maritime cooperation agreements with Russia. So that's underway. And then the third goes across the South Pacific island chains. And if we think about our geography in the Second World War, and China has studied this very, very closely, how the war was fought in the Pacific between the United States and Japan, one of the key elements for us was the Australia to California maritime corridor. The keeping us in the Pacific theater was a matter of being able to get to Australia and all of the islands in between. You know, as if we think about this as island chains, I mean, if those are under Beijing's influence and ultimately, in a longer game over a 10 or 20 year period, under their military influence that begins with economics, then they're going to have the ability to keep us out of the Pacific. And that was Mao's vision from the 1950s. He said one day, the Pacific nations are going to get together and throw America out of the Pacific.
And is
out
it
of the
your
island
measure
chains.
That the diplomacy represented by Wang Yi and the Belt and Road represented by Chinese investor class, that is persuading the Indo-Pacific? Is that your measure?
Well, look, I think a little bit of money goes a long way in some of the island states. So what they've been able to achieve in the Solomons, I think, is full spectrum at this point. I mean, there's security agreement, there's a lot of diplomatic engagement, and then there's certainly plenty of money coming from China. On the other hand, I mean, if you go up to the Philippines or to obviously our own allies in Japan or South Korea, I mean, we have a far greater ability to deal with this because we understand the nature of the threat and we're starting to come together as an alliance system. But we will have to bring non-aligned states onto our side. And that's been a challenge that I think is reminiscent of the first Cold War, where between two competing blocs, many emerging world nations, having just pushed off European empires, sought to chart a third way. And that was initially, India and China sought to lead that third way. And of course, China was not a good faith operator in that they fought their war with India and, tried to exert their own influence in the emerging world. But we're going to need to work to persuade non-aligned nations to the democratic side. I mean, I think, and we want to look at anchor states in different regions that matter, in states like Indonesia, which is a $1 trillion economy, states like Nigeria, which is, has an enormous population, states like Brazil, which is, we're headed in quite the opposite direction there. I mean, they've, Lula is now, talking about all sorts of things that I think are not favorable to the United States. But we're going to have to play a global game.
One of the paradoxes, India. What is China's approach to India? How do they envision India fitting into their supremacy?
Well, India, I think, for China, is a state that they seek to suppress ultimately, either to overwhelm it economically or to suppress it militarily or to do some combination of both. And I think India understands that. The border war of 1962 was probably one of the most important and defining moments in modern Indian history and foreign policy. The fact that so soon after Indian independence and even the declaration of 2,000 years of friendship with China, Beijing essentially brutalized them in the Himalayas and sought to dominate that region and to dominate the relationship. So I think India understands that. And then the question is India willing to take the necessary steps to swing to the right side of the gathering allies that are at this point looking to counter Beijing?
There are India alliances in the Indo-Pacific, and you mentioned. Is it willing to? It appears that there's the beginning of the alliances you recommend in your book. There's the Quad, there's AUKUS, there are bilateral relationships with Japan and with the Philippines. Does that begin to describe your understanding of a successful pushback?
Well, I think that's part of it. And I think that, this is all about existing alliance systems, many of which go back 70 years now in Europe and Asia. But what we also need is a two-track approach. I mean, on one hand, you have to consolidate the alliance systems that exist. But then we need strategies for the emerging world, which is at this point, by definition, not aligned. So from Latin America to Africa, to many of the Indo-Pacific nations, you have all sorts of parts of the world where Beijing has an upper hand because of their investment, because of their diplomatic relations, and because of their very clear vision of engagement with these regions where we are just simply not showing up. I mean, Larry Summers said recently that someone said to him, and I think this is one of the defining statements of the entire picture, America gives us a lecture and China gives us an airport. We have to be ready to play and win the economic engagement game, not with China, but with many other nations around the emerging world.
And in the Americas, you mentioned Brazil, but there are other states that have been very, very eager to accept Chinese investment. Do the states understand the choice between an autocracy and a democracy? Does it matter to them when they make the decision to go in debt to China?
Well, I think that is perhaps a much longer time frame in their view. I mean, what is true is that they need investment and they need trade. And if we're not able to provide that, then they are going to swing to Beijing. So I think that's the nature of the global economic contest, is that it's not just the U.S.-China relationship. It's a contest for the entire world economy. And we have the power of the world's largest market. I mean, we still are that. The largest economy, the largest center of wealth, all of that is true. And if you add up the entire alliance system and the world's democracies, it's the overwhelming majority of global GDP and wealth. So that should be more than enough if we're organized and focused on a real strategy to win an economic competition with Beijing. We should be able to provide investment and trade opportunities for many, many nations. But right now, we're just not in the game because we don't see it that way. And that's also why we're going to need our companies to be working with our government on long-term strategic initiatives to ensure that allied economic power prevails in the emerging world, and that we're providing real opportunities to emerging nations, and that that's not only coming from Beijing.
What is to be done? We'll turn to Jonathan's recommendations. The book is The Decisive Decade. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.